Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, hello there. This is Nate with yet another edition of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast where we get together and we talk about records and vinyl and turntables and music and all the stuff that we love and the format we enjoy. Got a very cool show today. We're going to talk a little. Actually, let me correct myself. Before I start plugging what we're going to be talking about, I first have to make an announcement. The Vinyl Guide is now on Facebook. Hooray! Yes, I joined the other third of the planet and now have a Vinyl Guide site on Facebook, which is facebook.com/vinylguide. Now, there's now three ways you can get a hold of us at the Facebook page, which is /vinylguide, Instagram at vinylguide, and the website that is www.thevinylguide.com. Why does the website have the article "the" in front of it instead of just Vinyl Guide? Well, because the guy who owns vinylguide.com is a domain squatting prick and wants a lot of money for the domain, which I'm not really willing to give him. So anyway, we have the website, which is thevinylguide.com, but the other formats, you guys can reach us without having to type those extra keystrokes. I'm saving you guys energy. You're welcome. So in today's show, I'm going to go over a few articles that I thought were pretty ironic that were sent in by some of the listeners. Thank you guys for your emails and contributing to the show in that way. I'll share with them. I think you'll hopefully think they're interesting as well, having to do with the White Album, the Beatles' White Album in the news. Also later on in the show, I'm going to be talking about the occult and rock and roll. Now, please know, whenever I say the term occult, I'm making these little finger quotey marks in the air, simply because the occult is just kind of this weird thing that I really don't get a lot out of, don't understand it that much, quite frankly. However, it is something that makes its way into rock and roll, and there is an occult figure, which I'll talk about, that made an indelible impression on a musician, which made a lot of records, and of course that musician made an impression on the record, on a record that you may have in your collection. So let's talk about that a little bit later. So are we ready to start the show? Let's do it. Now, first off, I want to start out by thanking all the listeners who have been sending in emails and tagging me in Instagram and liking the Facebook page so far. It's quite awesome. I'm glad there are a lot of folks out there who are finding information, finding it fun to listen to this podcast. Some of you have started sending me articles, sending me information, asking questions, that sort of thing. I try to answer you when I can. Sometimes I can't always do it, but I do appreciate it, and I do read all the emails that come through. By the way, those of you out there, you could always reach me at Nate, N-A-T-E, at thevinylguide.com. So this article came in actually from a few different folks, because I guess it's very heavy in the news right now. Very soon, there's going to be an auction in England. And in it, it has a lot of Ringo Starr's possessions, the things that he collected throughout his life. I guess Ringo has determined that he's not going to live forever, and a lot of the stuff that he's collected in his incredible life, he's going to start auctioning off and giving the money away to charity. So he and his wife have cleaned out their storage lockers and I guess the various houses that they no longer occupy, and they've started putting a lot of their things up for auction. There's about 300 of Ringo Starr's personal items in these auctions. Now, if you go to the Facebook page, /vinylguide, I'll go ahead and post some links up there where you guys can look at all the goody stuff that that Ringo and his family are selling off. There's a lot of furniture. There's quite a few gold and platinum records. There's awards that he's had for his work with the Beatles and his solo activities. There's an official script from the movie Help. However, when this script was written, it wasn't called Help yet, so the script is just called Beatles 2 because they were going to make their second film. There's a lot of clothing. There's a Liechtenstein painting, which I'm assuming is an original. I'm assuming all his artwork is an original because he's just kind of that kind of dude, right? There's a drum kit. Now, there's the actual Beatles drum kit, one of the ones from the 60s. I mean, you'd recognize it as, like, probably one of the ones that he played on, like, the Ed Sullivan Show in the auction. They're estimating that'll probably go for $500,000. I'm assuming it'll probably end up in Dave Grohl's house or something like that, but that is really, really cool. Now, if you cannot afford that drum kit, if you are not Dave Grohl, there is something that maybe you can afford, another drum kit, but this is a drum kit, and I'm quite serious. This is part of the auction. Ringo Starr is selling a drum kit from the video game Rock Band 2 for the Xbox 360. It is an actual drum kit owned by Ringo Starr. I don't know if he actually played the video game or played with along with it, but if you can't afford the $500,000 drum kit or you're not Dave Grohl, perhaps you could buy that one. So along with all these things that Ringo is starting to sell off is a copy of the Beatles' White Album. Now, this is a UK first mono pressing of the White Album, the top loading edition, which is one of the very, very early ones, but it has the number 00001. Apparently, this is the first White Album ever. Now, those of you with a little bit of familiarity with the Beatles and the White Album know that the White Album is really one of their landmark albums. I mean, it really is an album that's identified with the growth and the maturity of the Beatles. It was also written at a time when the Beatles were almost splitting up. It was one of the first albums that was written as several different songwriters rather than as a unit. It was right after Sgt. Pepper. It was at a time when Beatlemania had really taken its toll. The Beatles had stopped touring, and they were really in an exploratory mood. They were really looking to explore their individuality. You know, George wanted to start writing more. Ringo really didn't feel in place in the Beatles because, let's face it, the previous album, Sgt. Pepper, didn't really leverage him a whole lot. And then, of course, John was starting to date Yoko at this time. So there was a lot going on. Despite it all, the Beatles managed to write and record the White Album. Now, this is a double album and the favorite Beatles album for a lot of people. There's a lot of different music on there. It's very varied. A lot of it's experimental. So the Beatles White Album is really an incredible work of art. It is perhaps one of their biggest statements of the entire Beatles career. And I believe every record collector over 10 years old is familiar with the artwork of the Beatles White Album. It is plain white with just the words The Beatles. Again, a very strong contrast from the album they had previously, Sgt. Pepper, which is very colorful. So the White Album is, again, just plain white with the words The Beatles. However, as a gimmick or as some sort of artistic statement when they released the album, it was decided that each copy of the Beatles White Album would have a unique number. So they started this numbering system to be able to number each White Album individually, starting at, assuming, number one. Look, I started doing the research on it, and it really made my head hurt. The whole topic of the Beatles' White Album numbering really would require a PhD student, or maybe several of them, to unravel all the different variations and make sense of how all these individual albums are numbered. Now, to get an idea, head on over to the website whitealbumregistry.com. This is an online database that allows people to register their copies of the Beatles' White Album by number, and you can tell your location, and you can tell what kind of album it is, because there's several different types of numbering styles. Some of the numbers start with the letters N-O, as in number, and then it has the number. Some of them start with the letter A, and then go right into the number. Some of them start with the letter A, then a space, and they go right into the number. Some of them start with A, space, zero, whatever. Apparently, the differences between the mono and stereo have different styles of numbers. The original pressings were embossed, where later pressings had just a gray print number. The Australian release apparently started at 1,000 and had a different sort of prefix to it. So it's really hard to tell exactly where a lot of these White Albums came from in the order it rolled out of the pressing plant. However, I will say that this Ringo Starr White Album number 000001 does have quite a good provenance associated with it. It is part of Ringo Starr's personal collection. Apparently, the matrix numbers and the codes from the stampers all start with number one, which would indicate a very early pressing off a very early set of stampers. It is a top loader, which, you know, was the style of the day. Apparently, Ringo Starr got this White Album, probably from, you know, the Apple offices or whatever, and he took the number one and he put it into a bank vault where it's lasted there for about 35 years. The album apparently is in mint condition, as you'd expect, being kept in a bank vault for 35 years. Now, up to this point, the lowest number that had ever been sold of the White Album was number five, which was probably originally owned by one of the management or someone at Apple Records that was relatively close to the band. That copy in 2008 went for about $30,000. This album, with its provenance, and of course it is number one, it doesn't get any lower than this, will likely go for, I believe, somewhere between $80,000 and $100,000. Someone is going to pay for this album. It is going to be perhaps the most expensive record sold, at least in my lifetime, maybe. One single mass production record, let's say. So I believe the auction is in early to mid-December, I think December 3rd or something like that. So I'll definitely keep my eye on the news. I encourage you to do the same. And then perhaps in another few weeks, we'll talk again and we'll see what the record went for. But I'll definitely report back. Now, it was quite ironic that the same day I got links to the article about Ringo Starr's number one White Album up for sale, I also got links to a story about another White Album that's up for sale. This White Album, it isn't number one. In fact, it's number 118, looks like 02179. This is a White Album that is signed, you know, the signature, the autograph of Charles Manson and the Manson family, you know, Charles Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Leslie Von Houten, you know, the whole Manson family signed a copy of the White Album. And this White Album is up for sale as well. Now, you may remember the Manson family. They did the Tate LaBianca murders. They were a group of crazy hippies, really kind of whacked out on drugs and I guess maybe brainwashed by their leader, Charles Manson. And they committed some heinous crimes in Los Angeles in the late 60s. So it really is kind of a bit of creepy memorabilia here. What's more creepy, though, is that they were supposedly inspired to do these crimes through the song Helter Skelter from the Beatles, which is on this album. So it's highly likely that these individuals, if this was indeed their ownership and this is their signatures and this was an album that they shared, it is quite possible that this is the exact record that they listened to and got that horrible idea from listening to the song Revolution to go out and commit these crimes. Now, the Manson family copy of the White Album is up for sale for $50,000. So if you happen to miss out on the Ringo Starr 00001 White Album, you just don't have enough money. Perhaps if you're still looking for a copy of the White Album, well, maybe you can go this way. Who knows? I'm not sure who's going to be able to afford these copies. Hey, maybe it's the guy who owns VinylGuide.com. Yeah, you know, maybe he's a good businessman. Maybe he can afford these copies. So that's the update on these very unique copies of the White Album. We're going to watch this story. We're going to see what the outcome is. We're going to see how much they go for, and we'll definitely report back to you. If you want to see these links, you want to find out more, I'm going to go ahead and paste them into facebook.com/vinylguide. You can go read about it yourself, and of course, we can continue the discussion online as well. So for the second half of today's show, I'm going to talk about the occult and rock and roll. And again, when I say the word occult, it's with these little quotey finger gestures in the air, because to me it feels a bit odd talking about the occult. The occult is not something I believe in. I like to think of myself as a man of science, a man of logic. I value these sort of structures and laws that seem to govern much of what we do. And the occult is just, you know, a step removed outside of that. And, you know, I look for proof. So if there is proof of the occult, I haven't seen it. Of course, there's a lot of things I haven't seen in life. And it's also not something I want to spend a lot of time on because, you know, I don't need to do that looking for things that aren't there. And that goes with everything in my life, with the exception of crate digging. I'm always looking for stuff that is always not there. Anyway, that aside, I'm not a big proponent of the occult. However, I do need to admit that the history of rock and roll has a lot of kind of intertwining intersections with this occult. And I can understand why, because as a parent, you know, you want to raise your kids with the values that you have. And I'm sure back in the day, and even currently, there are parents who have raised their kids in particular backgrounds or with particular values. And then at some point when the kid starts to rebel, you look for something to blame. The parents want to point the finger at something outside of themselves to say, that's the problem. Little Johnny is doing something that I wouldn't agree with. It's not the values that I taught them, so it must be something else. They're not a bad person. I'm not a bad person. So it must be that other thing, that thing, that rock and roll. It's making them move. It's making them do all sorts of other things that I didn't teach them, so there must be something inherently wrong with that music. And of course, these record companies and these musicians and management, they see an opportunity there. They want to be able to sell their product and, of course, ride this wave of fear because, you know, there's nothing more tempting to a child than something that freaks their parents out. So, you know, you look at the types of records out there and you'll see companies and rock stars that are totally milking the whole fear of a cult. Just about every Black Sabbath album has some sort of weird, spooky, you know, mysterious overtone, upside down crosses on Ozzy's neck, devil horns and that sort of thing. And that stuff sells. And that's kind of overt, almost buffoonery type occult interplay, I guess, for lack of a better term. But what we're going to talk about today is one of the leading figures in this occult and his particular inspiration on musicians of the day, particularly one that has created a record that many of you may have in your record collection. Now, that record is Led Zeppelin III, and we're going to talk about that specific record a little bit later on. But first off, let me tell you about this guy whose name is Aleister Crowley. Aleister Crowley was born in 1875, the son of very wealthy parents. They owned a brewery. They had a lot of money. Young Aleister would never have to work a single day in his life, just live off his inheritance. All he had to do was keep his shit together. However, spoiler alert, that didn't happen. Aleister's parents were very religious. They had a very strict religious upbringing, and they subjected Aleister to this upbringing. He spent most of his teen years in a religious boarding school, taking all sorts of religious courses. However, Aleister started rebelling, and he started seeing a world outside what they were teaching him in this Christian boarding school. He decided to check himself out using his own money, went to Cambridge University, and decided to spend his time studying chess, poetry, and prostitutes. So much so that he caught venereal diseases very early on, and these may have contributed to a bit of his madness and behavior later on in life, as we'll discuss. He started considering his various career options. He was quite a mountain climber. He did several historic climbs for his time, so he was quite well known in that regard. He also considered a career as a diplomat. He had a lot of money. He had a very good name in the market. Of course, it was on a lot of bottles of beer, thanks to his father. However, he could have continued that trajectory and likely gone into politics if he wanted to. However, in his wanderings, he started getting into these mysterious writings, these teachings, again, I'm going to classify, maybe not as witchcraft, but the occult. It's just people doing these sort of rituals, hoping for some sort of supernatural occurrence as a result of these sort of incantations. Now, it struck a chord with him as he started getting involved in these different fraternities. Now, one of these fraternities he joined was called the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, or simply the Golden Dawn. Through that, he had an affiliation with a lot of other individuals who were really into this ritual, or they call it magic, with a CK on the end. And Alistair, being a man of means, thanks to his father, took some of his money and purchased a home in the Scottish Highlands called Bolskin House, where many of them lived while they practiced these rituals, took a lot of drugs, and of course, continued to study prostitutes. Now, Alistair continued to write poetry, write down rituals and his magic spells, and being a man of means, he did not have to bow to any book publishers. He could publish his own books. So he had a lot of, I guess, vanity publishing, you would call it, where he would do runs of 200 and 300 and 500 units of his books to be able to sell and share with friends. Now, in 1904, he came out with his most famous book, The Book of the Law, which essentially boils down to a single phrase that was, "Do what thou wilt, and that shall be the whole of the law," which is essentially, do what you want, dude, and no one should be able to stop you. Now, I am a bit punk rock, and I understand the desire for anarchy. I also appreciate the fact that I have a functional fire department in my neighborhood. However, this is a story about Alistair, not me, so I'll keep going on. Alistair continued to rise through the ladder of the Golden Dawn, but then he started fracturing with these fraternities. He decided to make his own for a while, then he partnered on another one. You could read the history. There's several biographies on Aleister Crowley. You could read the histories of it. A lot of it is very abstract. However, if you're interested in the life of Aleister to a much finer detail than I'll cover here, please check out one of those books, or there's several video documentaries online as well. Toward the end of his life, Aleister was running out of money. His inheritance is starting to dry up, and he started living the life of a con man. He would travel around the world. He was used to that sort of opulence and freedom, and he would talk his way into various hotels, tell them he was a prince, and of course, that being the time and the speed of communications was not like it is today, it would take the hotels sometimes weeks and months to find out that this guy's a fraud and he's not going to end up paying the bills that he's running up. Alistair also started selling his magic services to wealthy patrons. So for a certain fee or for financing his lifestyle, they would be protected spiritually because he would do rituals that would protect them. At one point during World War I, he even lived in the United States. He was lobbying on the side of Germany. However, once the war was over, he of course revealed to everyone, "Aha, I've been a spy all this time. I did my duty." And of course he got away with it because everyone just kind of shook their head and said, whatever. He made his way to Italy, where he lived in a villa in Sicily with a bunch of his followers. And of course, the money was running out and they were getting really worn down. He eventually died incredibly poor, absolutely no money, and fewer teeth, apparently. That's true. In his biography, they describe his body after he died as completely used up, that pretty much of a hobo. However, his reputation continued to live on, and it continued to inspire artists and anarchists for years to come. Even though Aleister Crowley died in 1947, leaving a burned-out, well-used corpse, he continues to inspire people to this very day. Several people who are in the rock and roll industry that you would have heard of. First off, there's a guy named Danny Carey, who is the drummer of the band Tool, phenomenal drummer of a phenomenal band. He is a collector of what's known as Crowleyana, and that is the collection of items that are somewhat associated with Aleister Crowley. Things he may have owned, things he may have used in his rituals, that sort of thing. He collects his books and whatnot. So Danny Carey is a guy who's fascinated by Aleister Crowley. You've heard the song Mr. Crowley by Ozzy Osbourne, right? Well, there it is, Aleister Crowley. That song is about him. Also, if you have no idea who Aleister Crowley is, and you think to yourself, oh, you know, this guy's a weirdo, I want nothing to do with him, well, guess what? You probably have a picture of him somewhere in your house. Go grab your copy of The Beatles' Sgt. Pepper. All right? You got it in front of you? Good. And now, see the guy in the back row, second from the left? That guy at the top? The bald guy? That's Aleister Crowley. He appears on the cover of The Beatles' Sgt. Pepper album. However, the person that Aleister Crowley inspired, perhaps to a more lasting degree, was none other than Jimmy Page, the guitarist, mastermind, and wizard of Led Zeppelin. Now, Jimmy Page currently holds the world's most extensive collection of Crowleyana. This is robes and wands and different things that Aleister used while doing his magic. He owns a lot of books. First-run editions of Aleister Crowley. In fact, Jimmy Page even bought Bolskin House, that home in the Scottish Highlands that Aleister Crowley used to own and do his rituals in. Well, yes, Jimmy Page bought that in the 70s, and that house actually features in the Jimmy Page sections of the movie Song Remains the Same. So, yeah, you could say he was pretty into Aleister Crowley. So in mid-1970, Jimmy Page was exhausted. He had just come off of an incredible 2 years of rock and roll. The previous 2 years, he had written, recorded, and released Led Zeppelin I and Led Zeppelin II, two incredible landmark albums, which I'm sure most of you are well aware of, and also toured extensively around the world. Led Zeppelin, in those 2 years, went from playing these very small halls into playing these huge arenas and being tremendous rock stars. In fact, a lot of pressure was on Jimmy Page to start developing the album that would become Led Zeppelin III. Led Zeppelin III had 85,000 advance units sold. So there was a lot of pressure on Jimmy to come up with a new album. However, he was completely burned out. He ended up renting a cottage and writing Led Zeppelin III in a state of exhaustion, really. So that's largely the reason why you listen to Led Zeppelin III. It sounds very different from Led Zeppelin II. Much more mellow, a lot more acoustic. That's just Jimmy Page trying to summon his energy and really turn things around, because the last 2 years must have been a real trip for him. But he was also now a man of significant means. Jimmy Page had a lot of money, and he started building his Crowleyana collection. Now, Jimmy Page admittedly was into Aleister Crowley when he was 11 years old. He discovered Aleister Crowley's books at a time in his life where today kids read Harry Potter, then Jimmy Page was reading The Law of Thelema and Sex Magic. So that may be partially the reason why Jimmy Page had such a strange life. I mean, as brilliant as a musician as Jimmy Page is, he's really kind of done some pretty dark and weird things in his life. He was very, very addicted to drugs in the 70s. He was really into humiliation of women and groupies. He even had the parents of a 13-year-old girl sign over custody to him, and they lived together for many, many years. So, yeah, he definitely is a guy with a dark side, no doubt about it. So in October of 1970, Led Zeppelin III as an album was completed. It was recorded and was ready for mastering. The engineer on the job was a guy named Terry Manning. Now, you may remember from a previous episode of The Vinyl Guide, I talked about Led Zeppelin II and how the mastering engineer at the time, Bob Ludwig, had mastered Led Zeppelin II so hot that the album essentially had to be recut immediately afterward because it was making the record skip on cheap record players. That was an expensive mistake that they didn't want to repeat again, so Jimmy Page, bit of a control freak, was in the room while the lacquer master was being cut. Now, after a mastering engineer does a successful lacquer cut, they have these etching tools where they can make little marks on the runout groove to denote, you know, what version it is, what master it is, any catalog numbers or anything like that. After they created a master of Led Zeppelin III, which everyone was satisfied with, Jimmy Page leans over to Terry Manning and says, write the following into the runout groove. Do what thou wilt. And Terry Manning dutifully wrote, do what thou wilt, which, as you'll remember, is a direct quote from Aleister Crowley from the Book of the Law. Do what thou wilt, and that shall be the whole of the law. When side two was mastered, Jimmy Page leaned over to Terry Manning again and said, write this, so mote be it. And again, Terry Manning dutifully wrote that quote, another Aleister Crowley quote, into the runout groove of the record. Those lacquer masters were then sent out to make the mothers, which made the stampers, which then stamped out hundreds and thousands of copies of Led Zeppelin III. So now, here is the fun part. Go get your copy of Led Zeppelin III and meet me back here in a moment. All right, here is the nerdy part of the show. Here's where we get into the dialogue about the differences and etchings and pressings and that sort of thing. So that's all right. That's what we're here for. Anyway, you have your copies of Led Zeppelin III handy? Okay, so we're going to go region by region because there's a few international differences. All right, we're going to start with the USA version. So USA version of Led Zeppelin III should be on an orange and green Atlantic Records label, catalog number SD7201. Okay, does your catalog have the number SD7201? All right, well, that is a good sign. Now, you see, Atlantic Records reissued Led Zeppelin albums many times in the last few decades, and around 1977, Atlantic Records decided to change their record cataloging system, and the format went from four numbers to five. So the catalog number for Led Zeppelin III, previously SD7201, after 1977 became SD19128. So if your catalog number is SD19128, it is not a first pressing of Led Zeppelin III. Okay, so for those of you who have SD7201 on the catalog number, let's move to the next thing. Look at the record label. Now, around the rim of the record label, you will see the address of Atlantic Records. Now, does your address say 1841 Broadway, New York, New York? If it does, all right, let's proceed to the next gate. Now, I must tell you, in 1975, Atlantic Records moved from their Broadway address to 75 Rockefeller Plaza. Now, it took a few years for that address to kind of permeate on all their record labels. They had old stock they had to use and whatnot. By 1977, all their record labels said 75 Rockefeller Plaza. So if your copy of Led Zeppelin III has the address 75 Rockefeller Plaza, I'm sorry, it is not a first pressing of Led Zeppelin III. Okay, so for those of you who still have catalog number SD7201 and the Broadway address, let's move on to the real telltale sign of a first pressing Led Zeppelin III. Now get your glasses on, you old people, because you're going to need to look at the runout groove. In the runout groove, you should see an etching. And that etching should be in the handwriting of Terry Manning, and it should say the words, "Do what thou wilt." Are the words, "Do what thou wilt," in the etching in the runout groove on side one? Hooray! Let's turn it over to side two. Now, does it say in the runout groove, same fashion, same penmanship, "So mote be it"? Woo! Well, then, if all those things line up, then you have a first edition USA pressing of Led Zeppelin III off the first stampers. Well done to you and your record cultivating skills. Now, a few of you are out there saying, well, you know what, the catalog number looks right, and the address looks right. However, I'm getting these different words. Mine doesn't say, "So mote be it." It says, "So mote it be," and it says it on both sides of the record. What's going on here? Well, there's no easy answer for that. I've seen lots of different permutations of the Led Zeppelin III stampers with all sorts of different text. I mean, it's the same phrase, but sometimes it's scrambled up. Sometimes the words "be it" and "it be" are inverted. The only thing I could really say about that is that when they cut a record master, when they do the lacquer mastering, that is not the only lacquer mastering. Now, probably after Jimmy Page left the room, they rolled out, you know, another half dozen of those masters. They may have forgotten exactly what Jimmy said. Was it "So mote be it" or "So mote it be"? And they could have screwed up that text along the line. So if you have a record that has those sort of characteristics, it is from that time period. It just isn't from that first set of stampers. All right, for those UK record collectors, bring out your Led Zeppelin III. Let's talk about that for a little bit. All right, Led Zeppelin III, the 1970 version, should be on orange and plum-colored Atlantic record labels, catalog number 2401002. Now, this edition should have both etchings, the Do What Thou Wilt and So Mote Be It, on side A and side B, respectively. However, there were a few different mistakes in the label run that were corrected over time. So let's take the first UK press. Look at your label. If you see the text at the very top of the record, just underneath where it says Led Zeppelin III, if it says Executive Producer Peter Grant, that is a first UK pressing of Led Zeppelin III. Now, another telltale sign is if you look at the catalog number. As I said, the catalog number was 2401002. If there is no dash, if it just looks like seven numbers run together, that's another sign that it is a first UK pressing of this record. Now, in the second UK press of Led Zeppelin III, in the catalog number, there is a dash between the fourth and fifth number. So the catalog number would actually read 2401-002. The text, Executive Producer Peter Grant, was also removed. However, in doing those corrections, one additional mistake was made. The song Celebration Day was actually titled just simply Celebration. They left the word day off of it. So if you have one of these orange and plum Atlantic labels with no Executive Producer Peter Grant, it has a dash in the catalog number, and Celebration Day is listed only as Celebration, you have a second run press of Led Zeppelin III. Still very cool, very early, and likely with those same stampers, but it's not that first ultra rare label. Still a great record though. I would not put that thing under the hamster cage. It's definitely worth keeping. Now the third and final edition of Led Zeppelin III we're going to talk about is from Japan. Now it was released in November of 1970 on blue and green Atlantic record labels, which were somewhat mimicking from the older Atlantic record labels out of the U.S. Japan still used that format. Catalog number is MT2043, and it came with a red OBI strip, and it went at the time for 2,000 yen, and the price tag is clearly on the front of it. In fact, it's probably one of the only English things you could read. The album cover had a spinning wheel, but there's no etchings at all on the record. It's just simply matrix numbers, no Aleister Crowley references whatsoever. So that's the story of Led Zeppelin III and those weird, mysterious etchings that were in the runout groove. Now, my personal story about that is I've got a Led Zeppelin III copy. I knew it was an early one. The cover had the matrix number SD19128, which signifies the 77 reissue. And I'd never really looked closely at the record before making this podcast. Now, in looking at all the materials, I pull out the record, and even though the cover is from the reissue, the actual record that I have is actually a first pressing. It blew me away. At some point in history, some owner had swapped the original first pressing copy with the cover of a reissue, and somehow I got it for probably about $5 or $6 somewhere. I can't even remember where I got it, but I was very stoked about that. So I guess that's a lesson learned. Everyone, always don't just look at your cover. Open it up. Look at the actual records. At any point, some person who smoked a lot of pot while they were listening to records could have accidentally swapped them around. Well, that's it for this edition of The Vinyl Guide. And look, if you have any of these records, either the Led Zeppelin III with the etchings or a variation that looked quite interesting, or even a white album with a really low number, I'd love to be able to see it. Shoot us an email, nate@thevinylguide.com. Post it on Instagram, tag me @VinylGuide, or hell, even go to our new Facebook page, facebook.com/VinylGuide. Join our community. Let's continue the dialogue online. Thanks very much for listening. And until next time, everyone keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @VinylGuide. Until next time, keep spinning.